Good evening, and welcome to our Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley program brought to you from the Sobrato Conference Center in San Jose. My name is Dr. Meredith Rudolph. It's my pleasure to introduce Harold McGee, author of Keys to Good Cooking, a guide to making the best of foods and recipes. Known as the Curious Cook columnist for the New York Times, Harold studied at the California Institute of Technology and Yale University, where his doctoral thesis was Keats and the Progress of Taste. He has since lectured on kitchen chemistry at such institutions as the Culinary Institute of America and the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Harold also teaches a three-day class at the French Culinary Institute in New York City. His first publication on food and cooking, The Science and Lore of the Kitchen, won the André Simon Memorial Fund Book Award in Britain. In 1995, Harold was elected to the James Beard Foundation's Who's Who in American Food, and 10 years later, Bon Appetit magazine named him Food Writer of the Year. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Harold McGee.
Good evening, everybody. My name is George Hadris. I'm the Director of Education for the Professional Culinary Institute here in Campbell. And I have about 30 years as a professional chef, so kind of a natural to interview Harold today. I'd like to welcome you, Harold. It is a distinct pleasure for me to be in this position.
Well, thanks. Wonderful to be here.
So I guess the first question that I'm going to start off with is, how does a literature major end up writing about food?
Well, I think even stranger than that is that I started out in astronomy. And then found my way to literature and then to food. So I went to Caltech as an undergraduate, majoring in astronomy, and studied for 3 years there, and decided after 3 years that while I was still in love with the ideas and the emotions evoked by what we were learning about the universe, I wasn't ready to do 12 hours a day of number crunching in order to have a career as an astronomer. So I, because it was the ideas and emotions that I decided I was really interested in, I switched to literature. And I stayed at Caltech to do that because they had a humanities faculty there. But the faculty, humanities faculty, had no students or very few. So when I asked them for letters of recommendation for transfer to a liberal arts school, they said, you know, if you stay here, we'll give you a really good education. And so I had tutorials in literature for the last couple of years I was there, and had a job at the Huntington Research Library, which is an amazing place. And then I got to cherry pick the science courses, which was perfect. So I moved from that to Yale and did graduate work there, got a PhD in literature, taught there for several years, was then unable to find a tenure-track position teaching. I had year-to-year contracts, but nothing long-term. And I'd been teaching writing, among other things. And so I thought one day, you know, maybe I should practice what I've been teaching and recoup my investment and my love of science and write about science. And thought that writing about the science of everyday life would be something different because, you know, Stephen Hawking was covering the universe and a man named Lewis Thomas was writing about biology and medicine at the time. He was an amazing essayist. So I thought, no point competing with those guys, but nobody's writing about everyday life. And food was the subject that I happened to pick. And I lucked out because this was the late 70s when things were pretty quiet on the food scene. And it took me long enough to write the book that by the time it came out, things were beginning to pick up. There was an increasing audience for this kind of approach to things, which at first did seem strike people as being a little odd. And now, happily, it's become fashionable.
When you first started this, did you like to cook?
I did, although I didn't know much about it. I mean, I was a graduate student or slightly past graduate studenthood, and so, you know, working with not the greatest of ingredients, but I loved cooking, and my friend, one of the reasons I picked the subject, in fact, was that my friends and I would get together regularly for potlucks. We'd all bring something together. Most of us had just recently discovered wine, and so this was a chance to explore a world that we didn't know anything about. And it was out of those conversations that really the idea developed. And then I kind of learned to cook and learned about food at the same time as I was writing the
book. Did you ever consider culinary school?
No. Seemed to me that working in a restaurant has to be one of the most difficult, demanding jobs there is in a variety of ways. And I really loved sitting in the library thinking. So
let someone else cook for you and bring it over. Huh?
Right, right. Or the other part of it, I like that. I also like going to my kitchen, having read something interesting in the library, and giving it a try, doing the experiment. That's the great thing about cooking is, you know, if you're an astronomer, then you have to wait 10 years and get $1 billion to do an experiment. And in the kitchen, it's stop at the store and cook something.
Yeah, I think it's interesting in the intro of the book, you talk about how recipes really can't be relied upon, and it was your objective to give people a foundation from which they could build. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it struck me, maybe this is partly my literary background, that you know, recipes for the most part are written documents, and like any written document, you have to interpret them. You have to see what they say and then try to translate that into whatever it is that you're going to try to make in your kitchen. And whatever recipe it is, it's been developed by an individual or a few people in a particular situation with a particular set of ingredients, a certain expertise, and it's easy for them to say, do this, do that, do the other thing, but now you're in your kitchen with maybe not the same equipment, not the same ingredients exactly. They say to turn on the heat and do this, and it looks as though it's about to be destroyed. What do? You have to start making decisions of your own. And so it just struck me that the more information, kind of general information, cooks have at hand in lieu of tremendous experience, which you and your colleagues develop simply by working day in and day out and just developing that kind of knowledge in your own, in your being. The rest of us have to rely on recipes and books like mine, which I hope will provide the information that the recipes don't.
We still have wrestling matches. But are we in any questions? Dan? I've got a couple, but I'm saving them.
Okay.
Great, thank you. This is a good question. This one's about Teflon pans. I've heard reports that Teflon pans are no longer safe to use. Can you discuss this, and what nonstick pans would you recommend?
Okay. Teflon pans have always had a downside, not just recently, but from the moment they were made, and that is that the coating that makes them nonstick, when it is heated above a certain temperature, begins to decompose and to produce toxic gases. It's got fluorine in it, and that's not good stuff for breathing anyway. So, you know, if you treat a Teflon pan carefully, you don't turn the burner on and then put the pan on and then forget that the pan's there, then it's not going to cause a problem because that decomposition temperature is way up there. It's like 800-900 degrees, something like that. But if you are concerned about the possibility of something like that happening, then it is better to pick something else. And until very recently, and kind of still now, I guess I would say there's nothing out there, no nonstick surface that matches Teflon in its
anodized
aluminum is a that's a ceramic coating, and at least in my experience, it doesn't come close to the kind of nonstick properties that Teflon does. But because it's become an issue, and because there is now a market for green nonstick pans, a lot of research has been going on, and new pans are coming out every year, and they're getting better and better and better. I wrote about these in the Times a couple of years ago, and there were a couple then that I wouldn't mind using, and they're probably even better now.
Okay, this is another question. This was one that I was going to bring up. I think a section on meats in the book is probably the most interesting to me so far that I've gotten to it. Mm-hmm. But you talk about meats should not be braised or stewed at temperatures over 180 degrees. Can you go into that a little bit?
Yeah. Cooking is ingredients plus heat for the most part. And if you get the proportions wrong, then you're not going to get a good result. And there's this idea that I've been screaming about ever since I wrote the first edition to On Food and Cooking about searing meat, sealing in the juices. We have all these kind of sayings that that cooks on television, while they're doing something in order to fill the silence, they'll say that are really misleading. And they often have to do with meat, and they often make it sound as though if you do this, then you're guaranteed a nice, juicy result. Cooking in a moist cooking environment like a braise will automatically give you a moist piece of meat, when in fact the quickest way to make a piece of meat dry is to put it in hot water. So the most important thing to remember about cooking meat is that the higher the temperature of the meat gets, the more moisture it loses. And if you want it to stay juicy, you want to keep it around 150 to 155 or below. And once you get above that, it gets dry and fibrous, and it's just a law of nature. No matter what cookbook will
do. So that kind of contradicts with some of the stuff that we talk about in terms of safe internal temperatures for certain meats, in particular, let's say, poultry or pork. Now, I agree with you. I got to say, 155 degrees is perfect for turkey. But by the book, it should be 165.
Yeah, that's right. So life is complicated.
Let's rewrite the book, which is what you did, I guess.
Well, yeah. What I tried to do in the book is say, if you want moist meat, this is what you shoot for. If you want a guarantee that the meat is safe, this is what you shoot mm-hmm. for. And unfortunately, those two desirable things are not necessarily coincident. In fact, if you want to be sure that any food you cook is safe, salads included, boil them. Then you can be sure. So you have to start making compromises and decide, you know, what's more important to you, what kind of risk are you willing to run. And, of course, if you're cooking for people who are at all vulnerable to illness, then you want to err on the side of safety. And if it's dry, put a little more gravy on. But if you want to get once in your life a really juicy braise or turkey breast or something, then you have to obey that particular law, which is that above 150, 155, it's going to get dry.
So really you should know and trust your sources for your proteins.
Yeah, that's right. Shop, do a lot of the work in the shopping. Yeah.
So here's another question. San Jose has extremely hard water. Does this have any effect on the taste and how food cooks?
Mm-hmm. Water can make a tremendous difference in all kinds of things. Coffee and tea in particular, where it's 98% of the product. And also in cooking vegetables, for example, or dry beans and peas. Hardness in water comes from minerals. One of those minerals is usually calcium, and calcium essentially firms vegetables. So if you try to cook dried beans in calcium-rich water, they may never get there because the calcium keeps the cell walls from falling apart. So the quality of the water can make a tremendous difference. And if you find yourself cooking things for way longer than the books tell you you should, anything more than a couple of hours for beans, anything more than 10 minutes for green vegetables, then it may be the water, and you may want to cook with bottled
water.
Is
the RO system an option?
Reverse osmosis, yeah, is a way of taking like care of that.
So this is a follow-up question on that. What impact does calcium salts have upon gelatin-based systems? You talked about greens, but what protein?
Proteins. That's a good question. I've never actually played with that with a simplified system to make sure that that's the case. But my guess is it has much less of an impact on meats and meat textures than it does on vegetables.
I know that we do some what I'm going to call molecular gastronomy. I want to ask you about that in a minute. But we have a sodium alginate and calcium chloride together to form. We make caviars.
Yes.
And we
yes.
take different vegetable juices. So I'm thinking there's some relationship to calcium and protein.
Well, except that alginates are actually carbohydrates. They're the seaweed equivalent of starch.
Right. So what happens then when we take a tomato juice and we make it into tomato caviar? Is there protein in the tomato that is...
No, proteins have nothing whatsoever to do with it. So you can make a and maybe we should explain what alginates and caviars are. This is an invention of a Spanish chef Ferran Adrià, who's best known for his foams. He's the person everyone blames for the existence of foams in modern food. but I'm convinced that he is a genuine genius. He's just an amazing. Creative mind, food or not, he's just remarkable. And one of the things he came up with, his idea was to ask, what can I do with food that has not been done before? Rather than being a traditional restaurant owner who says, okay, my customers come to my restaurant, he's in Spain, expecting traditional Spanish food, so I'm going to try to wow them with the excellence of traditional Spanish food. Instead, what he said was, I wonder if I can wow them by giving them something they've never experienced before. And this was one of the things he came up with, which he called caviar. And so what you do is you take any flavorful liquid whatsoever. It can be fruit juice. It can be a stock, anything. And you add a little bit of this seaweed extract, which is used in ordinary cooking in lots of parts of the world where people live along the seashore and have access to a lot of these particular seaweeds. So you put some of the seaweed extract into the juice, tiny amount, like a fraction of a percent by weight, so you can't taste it at all, and it is like a starch. But it has the property of only thickening in the presence of calcium. So what you do is you add the alginate to the liquid, and then you make a water bath that's got some dissolved calcium in it, and then you take a dropper and you make little drops of the flavorful liquid which go into the water bath, and then from the outside in, the calcium begins to gel the juice. And so you end up with a skin made of the same material as the inside, but it's solid, and on the inside it's still liquid. And then when you pop it in your mouth, it's like caviar. And you can do that with, you could do it just with water, and alginates are carbohydrates, so it's a protein-free system.
Great garnish on a salad. If you don't know what it is, you put it in your mouth, it goes, it's tomato. It's very cool.
No, it is fun.
So follow up on that. What's your general impression on molecular gastronomy?
Molecular gastronomy is a term that I really dislike because it sounds very, to me, pretentious and technical and misleading, because no chef who's using these modern techniques is really thinking about molecules. He's still, even if he's using alginates and...
Let's call it the chemistry of taste then.
Even if he's using liquid nitrogen, he's not thinking about molecules. He's thinking about ingredients, as he should. Mm-hmm. So what this movement is kind of the follow-on to Ferran Adrià's quest to find new things. I like to call it experimental cooking, And it's chefs who want to discover new kinds of textures, new kinds of combinations, new ways of giving pleasure with food. And while some of it is more successful than others, more than other things, and I've had both. I've had really good stuff and really bad stuff. And it does evoke strong reactions in people. Some people hate it and think it's one of the worst things ever to come along. The chef at Chez Panisse, David Tanis, has just come out with a book, and apparently he's pretty hard on people who do this kind of thing. My feeling is that the Chez Panisse approach to food is never going to go away. Traditional Italian and French and Spanish and Chinese foods are never going to go away. This is a fringe group of avant-garde chefs who are doing really interesting things. And some of it may stick. A lot of it probably won't. But I think it's great that they're exploring.
Yeah, for me as a chef, I think just exploration in textures, as long as it remains real food and not, you know, chemistry. So how about the technique of sous vide? Do you feel comfortable with that? Sous vide, for those of you who don't know, is cooking under a vacuum.
Well, so sous vide, that's true. The term is French, and it means under vacuum. But it really consists of two very different pieces. One is vacuum packing the food in plastic to isolate it from the water bath that you're then going to cook it in. But then the second part, and to me the most important part, is cooking in a water bath whose temperature is controlled precisely. And my feeling about that is, what took so long? You know, these things have been in the laboratory for decades. And as I said, cooking is heat plus ingredients. And if you can't control the heat, if you don't know what the temperature is, and you can't control how you're applying the heat to a food, then you're cooking with one hand tied behind your back. So the great thing, I think, about sous vide cooking is that you have temperature control down to a tenth of a degree with the immersion circulator that heats the water, keeps track of its temperature, and circulates it so that you don't end up with cool spots and hot spots in the same pot. It means that you can cook an egg to 141 degrees and not 140 degrees. And that may sound like nitpicking, but what happened when this came to the professional kitchen is that chefs began to say, okay, what difference does it make if I cook it to 100 or 141? And it turns out that in a certain temperature range where the proteins are beginning to set, every degree makes a difference, and you end up with a different texture at every different degree. And so you can now go to restaurants and they'll serve you a frisé salad with a poached egg, but the poached egg is a 63 degree centigrade egg. They'll specify on the menu so that you know exactly what you're going to get. And if you have eaten enough precisely cooked eggs, you know exactly what a 63 degree egg is. It's the perfect creamy yolk. And the white is still soft enough that it just kind of disappears into the salad as well. So I think sous vide cooking is great. The vacuum packing to me is much less significant than the temperature control.
As I mentioned, my friend Nils was in town. He did a demonstration with utilizing vacuum to enhance marinating and flavoring of different things. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So when you vacuum pack something so that it doesn't come into contact with the water bath, you take a piece of plastic, essentially, and it's kind of like a food saver machine, except that the professionals use what's called a chamber machine, where you put the bag and the ingredient in a machine, close it, lock it, and it pulls a vacuum on everything in there, rather than having something that's sucking air out of a bag in the kitchen. And when you do that, you can actually pull such a strong vacuum that anything that's porous, a vegetable or a fruit, for example, think of an apple floating. That means that it's mostly air inside, little pockets of air. If you put something like that in there, this machine will suck all that air out and completely deflate the apple. One of the most interesting dishes I've had is made this using this technique is a piece of watermelon that started out this thick and was smooshed down to a really, really thin layer, but it was so dense and concentrated in flavor that the chef called it a carpaccio of watermelon, and it had a really meaty flavor, and it was pure vegetable or pure fruit. So you can do that kind of thing. You can also take something like meat and put a marinade in the bag, which is unfortunately something you can't do with a food saver, is use liquids because they just get sucked out with the air and then you end up with a mess. In a chamber machine, you can put a marinade in the bag, and then in the process of making the vacuum and then releasing it, the many fewer but still air pockets in the meat get filled with the marinade. The marinade gets pushed into the meat, and so rather than kind of slowly working its way in, it gets put in right away.
Let's move away from technical to a little bit more something common in everybody's kitchen. My brother-in-law is an engineer and absolutely refuses to believe that letting meat rest after cooking is essential to having juicy meat. What can I tell him? Is there science to back it up?
There is indeed science. And the simplest way to put it is that the water-holding capacity of the tissue is higher at low temperatures. So, and one way that he might be able to think about it is if you, you know how if you cook a, heat a liquid, a sauce, the hotter it gets, the thinner it gets. When it cools down, it thickens up again. And that's essentially what's happening, one of the things that's happening in the piece of meat. As it cools down, I mean, some of the liquid is actually being pulled back into the tissue from whence it came. But another part of it is that those juices change their viscosity with temperature. And so the hotter the meat is, the more easily they flow out. The cooler the meat is, the slower it flows, and so the more likely it is to stay.
So we want to leave it set on the cutting board before we cut it.
That's right.
Any timing?
It depends so much on the size of the cut. So a roast, you'll want to let sit for quite a while, partly also to compensate for what's called carryover cooking. A big roast, the outside of the meat is much closer to the oven temperature than the inside, and so even after you take it out, if you think of yourself being at the center of that cut of meat, you're not aware that it's come out of the oven yet because the outer parts of the meat are still way hotter than you are. And so it takes a while for that equilibrium to work itself out and for the whole piece of meat to cool down.
Okay. This was one of my questions. I get into discussions with my colleagues regarding salting meat before you cook it or after you cook it or both. What's the book on that?
Well, I think that's the kind of question where, you know, you can make arguments for all three, and it kind of depends in the end what you prefer. And then you'll use whichever argument to justify your position. So I'm a proponent of all three. The people who say don't salt to begin with usually say don't do that because that draws out the juices, right? Well, actually, that's a good thing because if you draw the juices out, the moisture is going to be evaporated by the high heat, and what you end up with is the flavorful parts of those juices being dried out on the surface of the meat and contributing to that brown crust that's the whole point of cooking meat on a grill. So that actually, I think, provides more flavor. But it is true that you do lose some juice during the cooking process, and so I think what you want to do is check the seasoning afterwards, add salt again if necessary. If not, if you hit it right the first time, then leave it alone.
Does salt provide aroma enhancement?
It does, indirectly. Salt itself, of course, doesn't have an aroma. You whiff a salt shaker and there's nothing there. But what salt will do in a liquid with aromatic molecules is it'll actually make the liquid less friendly an environment, chemically speaking, for those aromas, which means that they get driven out. They're not happy being dissolved anymore, so they come out more easily. And when they come out more easily, that means that we smell them more, and that means that to us the food has more aroma.
Okay. There are a number of products on the market that claim to keep produce fresh longer. Do you think any of them work?
Well, yeah, there are a couple that I think do work, although a lot depends on how you use them and how you manage your refrigerator in general. There are bags that are semi-permeable. They allow limited amounts of carbon dioxide and oxygen in and out. And that can be a good thing because you want actually to slow the metabolism of fresh fruits and vegetables in the fridge to prevent them from going bad. And controlling their atmosphere so that there's not too much oxygen, but there's also not too much so much carbon dioxide that they begin to suffocate, that's a good thing. Then there are also little discs of potassium permanganate, which actually absorb and destroy ethylene, which is a ripening hormone and a wound response hormone that plants will make. And that, again, encourage, it's kind of like those of us who get sick getting a fever or something like that. It kind of slows the response of the fruit and vegetable to the stress that it's being put under, and that makes it last longer.
There are a number of reports that organic foods are better than conventionally raised foods. Is there any validity to that statement, and are they more nutritious? Where might one find solid information about this?
That's a very good question. Where do you find solid information? Because pretty much everyone involved in investigating it has a vested interest. And a year and a half or 2 years ago, I wrote a piece in the Times about a report from an organics institute providing kind of a literature review and saying, finally, it's clear as the result of these several hundred studies that there is a pattern, and the pattern is that organic foods are more nutritious. But then when you burrow down into the reports, I was really disappointed. There really wasn't anything there. It was a lot of reports, but they were so scattered that none of them really offered what looked to me like convincing evidence.
At the school, we've done some kind of blind studies, and in working particularly with chicken, I'm thinking, we had some Foster Farms fryers and some, I think, Mary's is the brand that we use that are organically grown. And Foster Farms won out every time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So this was just based on flavor alone,
yeah.
Not on politics at all.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It was and cooked identically,
mm-hmm.
And I mentioned it to Nielsen. He said they did the same thing in New York, and they had the same result.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
Well, so I would say about that result that there's one really important confounding variable, which is that most people grow up eating Foster Farms chickens or the equivalent. And the more we learn about taste and smell and food preferences, the clearer it is that we're just barely conscious of all these things that inform our responses to things to foods, and so that might be a big part of it.
I think that really comes into play too when you have the opportunity to travel and you mm-hmm. go to a foreign country and you taste foods that are indigenous to that country, and come home and gather the same ingredients and try and replicate it, and it just doesn't
happen.
Yeah,
yeah,
so.
Yeah. One other interesting point, though, on the question of organics. When we think about nutritiousness, we're usually thinking about vitamins and minerals and things like that. But in recent years, we've become more aware of what we now call phytochemicals, these other things that aren't classic nutrients, that do somehow seem to be beneficial to us, some of them because they're antioxidants, others because they change the way we metabolize other elements of the diet that are not so healthful. And it turns out, and this is a very real phenomenon and very interesting, plants that are grown in organic conditions, which means they're not helped out with herbicides and pesticides, are faced with a lot more stress. They do get attacked more by insects. I know when I first started to get interested in food and would go to what passed as co-ops back in the 70s, that the organically grown produce was pretty ratty looking. You know, it had had a hard life. But it turns out that a hard life is a really good thing for the phytochemical content of these plants, because these phytochemicals, many of them are defensive compounds. They're things that the plants produce in order to convince the caterpillar that has just showed up that it really doesn't want to eat that plant. So it makes these things that are bitter tasting. I mean, the reason that Brussels sprouts, for example, or collard greens are bitter is because those plants use those compounds as defensive compounds. They turn out, for serendipity that I still don't understand, to be good for us. And so plants that are grown under stressful conditions and don't look so great often have more phytochemicals, and often, in the case of herbs, have more flavor than conventionally grown produce.
Yeah, now that I mentioned it, I have never seen a snail on a dandelion green.
Uh-huh.
And I love dandelion greens. Are there any ingredients or cooking methods that have fallen out of common use that you would like to see come back? Uh-oh.
The lights.
Yes.
Well, at least the microphones are still working, it sounds. Okay. That would explain it. Let's see. Ingredients or techniques? That's a good question, and for the moment I'm stumped. I'm sure there are, but...
Do you have a cuisine that you prefer among others, regional cuisine?
Well, one of the things that fascinates me about the subject and why I'm still writing about it after so many years is that I love the diversity. But that said, my mother was born and raised in India. And so from a very young age, I've had Indian food, and I do have that left its mark. I love to make curries. And by the same token, I love to make moles, which it seems to me are the new world, not equivalent, but cousin of curry, where, you know, instead of in French food, you take ingredients and you kind of refine the essence and get that and present that in a very elegant way. The reverse of that, I think, is the sort of all-in school of cooking, where you throw in 20 different spices and then cook that mixture to some amazing new thing that didn't exist before. And I love that aspect of Mexican and Indian cooking.
What's your thought on wooden versus plastic cutting boards?
Yeah, another controversial subject where you can make perfectly reasonable arguments on both sides, which to me means it doesn't matter. They each have their points. It turns out that wood is porous and absorbent and also contains materials like those defensive compounds in fruits and vegetables that tend to inhibit the growth of microbes. So they're very good in their way. Plastic cutting boards are much easier to scald in a dishwasher. They both end up with nicks, and I think wooden cutting boards deal better with nicks than plastic ones do. But it kind of depends on what you feel most comfortable working with.
Okay. There are numerous types of milk on the market, but recipes never state what kind is best to use. Does it matter what type of milk is used for baking and cooking? What about the nutritional value of these different types of milk?
Well, my feeling is that when you're cooking and you want something to taste good, you use the most flavorful ingredients possible. And for that purpose, I think nothing beats full-fat milk, whole milk, yeah.
Whole
yeah.
Raw milk,
Is something that I love to work with because it has even more flavor than pasteurized whole milk. Pasteurized whole milk is generally homogenized, and that essentially takes any flavor that the milk has and kind of sticks it to the surface of the fat globules in the milk. Because you start out with relatively large fat droplets in milk. When you break them down, you increase their surface area, and those surfaces just absorb all the flavor. So I love raw milk, but it does present issues of safety, price, availability. It doesn't keep as long, so it's got a lot of practical disadvantages.
Have you done any research on the health aspects of raw milk? I've done some reading, and there seems to be like the magic cure-all for many things, or at least claims are.
Right, yeah. And I feel about raw milk the way I feel about the claims for raw food in general, which is that these foods may be good for you, but it's not their rawness that makes them raw, makes them good for you. And in the case of, the proponents of raw foods say that raw foods are still full of the enzymes that the fruits and vegetables and milk had, and that's an important part of the nutritional and health value. There are a couple of problems with that. One is that they're enzymes for that creature, not for us. And so we have human enzymes, and green pepper enzymes are not going to do us a whole lot of good. And once they get into our bodies anyway, they're proteins. Enzymes are proteins, and our bodies immediately take proteins and break them apart into amino acids before we take them into our bodies. That's how we absorb them as amino acids and not proteins. So it's not an argument that makes sense.
I'm about three-quarters of the way through a book called Catching Fire, How Cooking Made Us Human. Are you familiar with that book?
Yes, yes.
Very interesting. And one of the things it talks about is that the primitive humans and before the species before humans mm-hmm. spent an enormous amount of time chewing because they were eating raw foods. And as we started using fire to cook, it became easier to eat the food, and we were getting higher quality protein, and voila, we have brains.
You know? Right, right. And also, a lot of nutrients, especially fat-soluble vitamins, mm-hmm. We don't absorb unless the tissue has been cooked, because they tend to exist in, say, the lycopene in tomatoes or the beta carotene in a pumpkin. They exist in the food, and usually in the form of crystals. And if you just eat them raw, we don't break all the cells apart. We can't get at them, and so we absorb a tiny fraction of the nutritional value of that food. If we cook them and disrupt the cells, break them open, and even better, eat some fat along with it, because these are fat-soluble vitamins, then we end up with a much better extraction of the nutritional value of that food.
Going back a little bit to what we were talking about organics and sustainable foods, and I think I can speak for a lot of people in that they would probably practice shopping these items if they weren't so expensive. How long do you think it's going to be before sustainably grown products and organically grown products are going to be at a price that the working person can afford?
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe never. And I say that as someone who's lived in France for a year, and I paid much more for food there than I pay here. And it felt worth it. And I think there's not only the issue of affordability, there's also perception of affordability. And if you decide food and nourishment are two of the most important things in my life, then I'm going to be willing to pay more than, you know, a dime per egg. Maybe I'll pay 50, 60, 70 cents per egg because it's important. And that's still so cheap. So I think just standing back and thinking about, you know, how much if you balance the cost against, say, a fast food meal or a meal at a restaurant you might go to every week, you know, on a Friday or something like that.
Well, certainly America has a long way to go with its consciousness about food.
Yeah, yeah.
So, okay. In the last few years, what innovations in food and cooking have you seen that has really excited you?
Well, I guess I would return to temperature control. The fact that, you know, in the 21st century, we're discovering what you can actually do with an egg, or by the same token with meat or fish, all of these protein-rich things whose texture and flavor depend a lot on the temperature give you very different possibilities nowadays with that chance to control temperature. So that's right up at the top. And then I do feel that there's just a general general value put on food, the experience of eating especially, but also cooking these days, that just wasn't there when I started writing. And that's wonderful to see.
Can you elaborate on flavors developed with butter, salt, and cream and fat versus the more healthy substitute food products?
It is true that all those fatty materials have characteristic aromas and they have characteristic textures. They feel good in the mouth. Creaminess is something that we love, and they are kind of hard to replace. But olive oil, if you get to know it, can be, I would say, even more interesting, simply because olive oil comes from a fruit. It's not like seed oils that are just pressed from, you know, thousands and millions of identical corn kernels or soybean seeds. They come from fruits that are harvested when they're ripe. They have very specific characters depending on the variety of tree, the country, the climate, all kinds of things. And there's a great pleasure, I think, to be taken not in, you know, they don't taste like butter, true, but they give you the same satisfying feeling in the mouth, and they offer a kind of different world of flavor that's very much worth exploring.
Here's a question. What is the difference between conventional cooking and microwave cooking with the effects on nutrients?
I'm glad you asked that question. Microwaves are so much better. Everyone has the opposite impression, but it's an impression. And if you the studies have been done over and over and over again in countries, I mean, France, Italy, you name it. If you take the same vegetable and do a side-by-side comparison, cooking them to the same doneness in boiling water, in steam, in a pressure cooker, and in a microwave oven, microwaves come out on top every time. And the reason for that, and it does make perfect sense when you stop to think about it, microwave energy is simply another form of electromagnetic radiation, which is what infrared radiation, heat, is as well. So we think of it as this completely different, strange, bizarre, modern, unnatural way of cooking. And it is, to the extent that it was only recently that we were able to control it. Stars, getting back to my astronomy, stars make microwave radiation all the time. So it's natural in that sense. And it turns out that microwave radiation, unlike heat radiation, ordinary heat, can penetrate some distance into food while it's being absorbed, which means that, and it's absorbed primarily by water in foods. So you can take a ceramic container or a glass container, put it in the microwave oven, turn the energy on, and all that's getting heated is the water in the food itself, not the container. And it's heating very quickly because the energy is penetrating the food. And the reason that's great is that you lose nutrients in food either when they get leached out, as when you plop them into boiling water, or when enzymes in the food, as the tissue is beginning to fall apart under the action of the heat, when enzymes in the food begin to degrade the vitamins that are in there. And that's what happens to vitamin C, but also the B vitamins. So the faster you can get the temperature up past the denaturing temperature of those enzymes, the more of those nutrients you'll preserve. And microwaves are just unbeatable.
Okay, here's a different angle. With the growing popularity of the Food Network and other competition-based shows such as Top Chef and Hell's Kitchen, Are there any of these shows that you watch?
I watch the shows that my friends are on. Because then I have a personal interest in the outcome. I used to watch them all to begin with, but to me they all became kind of the same. You know, it's all a race against the clock, and I don't really learn anything from watching them because the emphasis is on the competition and not so much on learning an interesting new way to make something. You know, the actual shots of cooking are maybe 3-4 seconds maximum, and that's not enough time for me to learn, and I want to find out something new.
So kind of on that same note, who is your culinary hero and why?
I might pick someone, because I have a lot of friends in the business, and can't pick just one of them. I would go back to the 18th century, to a contemporary of Benjamin Franklin's, who would be as well known as Benjamin Franklin, except that he picked the wrong side in the Revolutionary War. So he was a traitor and went to Europe and did everything interesting in his life in Europe. But he was the guy, his name is Benjamin Thompson, Count Rumford. He was a count of the Holy Roman Empire, but born in Vermont. And he was, I think, the first person who really loved food and cooking, who took a scientific approach to making things better. So he wrote monographs on a better coffee pot, and it's essentially the design that we use today. He invented the prototype of the modern oven, you know, a metal box heated from the outside rather than cooking over an open fire. And he did that partly because he saw that in institutional kitchens in Europe, the lifespan of the average cook was 25 years. You know, they were breathing these poisonous fumes day in and day out. So he found a way to vent the fumes to the outside and cook the food in an enclosed space. But he also discovered low-temperature meat cooking by accident by designing a potato dryer, which would operate at maybe 180 degrees, something like that, just to dry out potatoes to keep them. And he decided one day he was going to do an experiment and threw a leg of mutton in there. And after 3 hours, nothing much had happened, so he just closed the door, went away for the day, came back the next morning, and it was perfect. But he didn't stop there. This to me is what marks him as a genius. He then, to demonstrate that, objectively speaking, this was a better way to cook meat, he cooked a leg of mutton over a fire. He cooked a leg of mutton in his potato dryer, and then he threw a party. And he put one at one end of the room and the other at the other end of the room, and didn't tell anybody about either one of them. And at the end of the party, he weighed what was left and ended up with a quantitative measurement of the popularity of potato dryer meat. So he's the father of kitchen science, I think.
Genius.
Yes.
Can you give us a non-scientific explanation of umami?
Umami, yes. I just got back from Japan, actually, my first visit. And umami is a Japanese term, and it means deliciousness. And it's the fifth taste after sweet, sour, salt, and bitter. And the Japanese have been claiming since about 1908, in fact, since exactly 1908, that there was this additional taste, and that's why it has a Japanese name, because Western scientists said, no, not true. Maybe there are things that modify taste, but we've only got four. And then about 10 years ago, Western scientists discovered on the tongue receptors for monosodium glutamate, which is the classic producer of the taste of umami. So we have taste receptors for it. The Japanese have known about it for hundreds of years, and we finally come around to agreeing that there's something there. So umami is the best way to describe it, I think, is it's kind of mouth-filling. It's not you know, as easily definable as acidity, for example, or bitterness, but it is something that gives a kind of fullness and roundness of flavor. And it comes from a handful of different chemicals, just as bitterness and saltiness come from chemicals, so there's nothing unusual about that. It's on many people's lips recently, because it's only recently that people here have agreed that it's real.
So your feeling on monosodium glutamate as a food additive?
Is that, first of all, monosodium glutamate or glutamate, which is an amino acid, is found in many, many foods, but in especially high concentrations in fermented foods like Parmesan cheese, and in tomatoes, and in meat stocks, long-cooked classic French meat stocks, because it's a component of the protein, and it accumulates and concentrates as you boil it down. So we've had it in our foods, and it's part of what we enjoy when we enjoy Parmesan cheese. It's that richness that we love. It's the meatiness of the tomato, which is a fruit, and yet we treat it as a vegetable. Part of the reason for that is the MSG. So it's there in natural foods. Using it as a food additive, for me, is a different story, because what that means is you're compensating for the absence of it in your ingredients by adding it as a pure chemical. And I think that's less admirable than finding good ingredients and coaxing it out of those ingredients the way people have traditionally.
So the reaction that certain individuals claim to feel when they have consumed MSG is due to what, you think?
Well, that, again, like the effects of microwaves on nutrients, has been studied hundreds of times in countries all over the world, and the consensus is that there really is no such thing as the Chinese restaurant syndrome. If you solicit people who have bad experiences and are convinced that they have an MSG reactivity, and then give them a placebo or MSG, and they don't know which is which, they can't tell the difference, and they don't develop symptoms. So one of those ideas that got traction for not very good reasons way, way back, and it's just persisted, like searing meat seals in the juices.
I find that various salts seem to have different aromas. Is that the result of other minerals, and which are in the salt? And then second follow-up question, what type of salt do you like to cook with best?
Well, salt that is pure salt is not going to have an aroma because it's just sodium chloride. But if it's a sea salt, which means that it's been evaporated, well, and I should qualify even that, because a lot of salt, ordinary salt, comes from the sea. All the stuff that's being harvested in the bay, the stuff that makes the bay red when you're flying in, those are salt beds. And the reason they're red is that microbes that can tolerate high salt grow there and give the water that color. So a lot of very ordinary salt is technically sea salt because it came from the sea. But if you make a point of emphasizing the oceanic origins of sea salt by not refining it to the extent that Morton's does, so that it's still somewhat moist and it has impurities, then it can smell of the sea, and things can grow on it. In fact, there are bacteria that will survive inside dry crystals of salt. And if you dissolve the salt, they come out, they sprout, they start growing. So on wet sea salt, fleur de sel and things like that, you can have microbes growing, and they can be contributing an aroma.
Okay, this question's been asked like half a dozen times. As a Bay Area native, what's your favorite restaurant?
I can weasel out of that one. I'm not a Bay Area native. I live now in San Francisco. I lived for many, many years in Palo Alto, but moved up to San Francisco a few years ago. And I guess my favorites are my neighborhood restaurants. They're the places where I go where I feel most comfortable, where the food is wonderful, not spectacular, not mind-blowing, not they haven't changed my life, but they've made my life tremendously pleasurable. So I live in Noe Valley, and Incanto is one. It's an Italian restaurant. Contigo is another, a Spanish restaurant. And then I'm only a few blocks from the Mission, and there are just too many. There a lot of them are wonderful.
In writing this book and in putting it together your previous other books, what resources did you use? To collect that much information into one tome is just mind-boggling to me. is there any, what do I want to say, method or path that you followed?
Yeah. You know, to begin with, it was much harder. I started writing in the late 70s. And I did it on a typewriter. There were no personal computers. And if I had a question, I would go to a library and look up the journals and look in the index volumes of 10 or 15 years to see if I could find a keyword. And if I couldn't in a certain amount of time, I just had to move on. So that was a very limiting way to do research on a book like this. When I did the revision, which came out in 2004, in a way, there was too much information available. And what I would do was, for a given chapter, the first chapter I revised was on dairy products. I would drive up to UC Davis, which has a spectacular food science department, a great enology and viticulture department, and it's a public university, so the libraries are open to all. And I would rent a motel room, and then the library opened at 7 and it closed at 11. And I would be there with a lunch break for those hours. I would have dinner after 11. And I would just spend the day in the library collecting information, whether that meant downloading or Xeroxing or taking notes. And I would do that for about a week and then come back down to Palo Alto and digest and annotate and edit down and write a chapter. And then the next chapter would come along, I'd do the same thing.
How long did this book take?
Keys to Good Cooking took 3 years. But that was a different kind of enterprise. I was more drawing on my own experience. Science kind of takes a back seat in this book, which is more about, it's a practical guide to working in the kitchen. So the advice comes first, and then there's a phrase of explanation just so you don't think I'm making it up. And that's all for the science.
Well, we've gone through our hour, and just one final question. What's next?
What's next? A book about flavor, taste and smell and flavor, starting in January. I can't wait.
I can't wait either. Well, on behalf of the Commonwealth Club and everybody here and cooks everywhere, I'd like to thank you. And I guess you'll be able to sign books after. Is that right?
Yes. Okay. Yes. My pleasure.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I'm sure you all enjoyed this evening's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club, Silicon Valley. Again, we'd like to thank Harold McGee, author of Keys to Good Cooking, A Guide to Making the Best Foods and Recipes, George Hadris, Director of Education at the Professional Culinary Institute, our audience here in San Jose, and those of you joining us on the radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.